Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And good afternoon, everybody. This is the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak, and we greatly appreciate you taking time today to join us for another edition of Midrats. And for those that are new to the show, if you have some ideas you would like to contribute during the course of the show, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find the chat room and roll in with the usual suspects. If you have some questions you would like to ask, that's a great place to put your question in, as we'll be monitored during the course of the program and we'll be glad to flow your ideas in as we move along during the course of the hour. And if you have to leave halfway through the show for some reason and you'd like to catch up on what you missed, or if you would like to listen to some previous episodes, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can just take the shortcut and subscribe to the free podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. But let's go ahead and hop in with the rest of the show. And today, for the full hour, we're going to touch on again the next edition of an ongoing series of interviews we are with the editors of the different books of the 21st Century Foundation. Now, this iteration is 21st Century Knox, and the editor is David Conan. And he had a real interesting quote that I put in some of the prior works. And it's from the subject of our work, Commodore Dudley Wright Knox, United States Navy, as somebody who, quote, challenged fellow naval professionals to recognize the inherent relevance of history in examining contemporary problems. In his writing, Knox cited historical examples when strategists foolishly anticipated the unknown future without first pursuing a detailed understanding of the past, unquote. And for you Midrats regulars, understand why that definitely gets our attention and really has us looking forward to the next hour with Dave. Just a little background on him. Dave has a PhD with the Lawton Chair of Naval History at University of London, King's College. He is the author of Commanders Wynn and Knowles, Winning the U-Boat War with Intelligence, as well as other works, and you can find links to those works over at the show page. But enough of that, let's go ahead and get on with the show. Dave, welcome to Midrats.
Well, thank you for having me.
Appreciate you coming on, and I'm looking right here at a very young-looking Commodore Knox at the front of 20th Century Knox. And I wanted to, because when I saw the title first, first thing that went to mind, like most officers or retired officers of a certain age, was the Knox-class frigate. I was like, oh, so that's the guy. And mm-hmm. in the course of reading the book and what little I knew of Knox actual himself, is he was one of those guys that was always in the picture, two or three seats to the right or the left, of some of the titans of this era that most people who even have an engineer's knowledge of naval history might recognize. And we'll probably touch on some of those during the course of the show. But as the editor of 21st Century Knox and is kind of a scene setter for the show, if you could outline for us who Commodore Knox was and what about his body of work put him in with the rest of the leaders that we see in the 21st Century Foundations.
Yeah, well, I was gravitated to Dudley Knox because of my other research. I wrote a long time ago about Commander Kenneth Knowles, who was the counterpart to Roger Wynn during the Second World War, who tracked submarines. And I've always been interested in the sort of middlemen, the people just below the senior levels of command, which is an area that many historians don't go into because, you know, they're so fascinated either by the tactical or the strategic level commanders. So I'm gravitated towards people like Knox because he's the guy that's actually sort of coordinating the strategic and the tactical. And Knox is a fascinating character, as you know, because he had so many different sort of facets. He was obviously a naval officer of the first class, you know, he's part of that sort of generation of people who really created the Navy that we have today. They built the Navy second to none, and it didn't happen overnight, and it was that generation that had the vision to recognize that navies are different than any other sort of branch of service. You know, armies operate on land, and of course you have the air forces flying in the skies, but it was people like Dudley Knox who recognized that you didn't need a war to justify a navy. And, you know, one of the things that I think is interesting about him is he also used history to illustrate his strategic points in a contemporary context, you know. And I think that's part of the reason why people like Franklin Delano Roosevelt also gravitated to Dudley Knox. You don't hear much about him, but he had a tremendous impact. I like to think of him as the sort of consigliere of the Navy, the key advisor to Ernest King, Betty Stark, the CNO before Pearl Harbor, and, of course, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, tremendously important figure who really hasn't gotten a lot of attention by historians.
When you set this book up, and I don't know whether you were the one who arranged the chapters, but you start off, I think the first chapter is called Marching to the Sound of Guns, but it's interesting in the sense that every junior officer has faced this issue. Why am I being micromanaged and I don't understand what's going on above me? Can you kind of talk about how you approached that issue and why you chose the selection you did for him on that kind of topic?
Yeah. So Knox, like any naval officer, somebody mentioned earlier, a young looking Knox, he's actually, he's over 40 years old in that picture on the book. This guy, when he was growing up, when he was a young naval officer, always was drawing inspiration from studies of history. And he and his contemporaries, like Ernest King, used to quiz each other on, you know, Napoleonic history. It's interesting if you can sort of picture yourself in the wardroom back in the Great White Fleet days, if you can picture two young naval officers giving each other quizzes to see if they can stump each other on you know, esoteric questions of Napoleonic history and the Civil War as well. And so I chose the title Marching to the Sound of Guns because, you know, Knox actually makes reference to Clausewitz in that particular chapter. And, of course, Clausewitz talks about the importance of marching to the battle and all that and the sound of guns. So it's that Napoleonic inspiration that initially inspired Knox, and so I chose that chapter title. And of course, you know, there's another figure of great importance in Knox's life, and that's William Souden Sims, who was nominally the commander of U.S. naval forces in Europe during the First World War, but before that, he went to the United States Naval War College, where he was in the same class as Dudley Knox. And they used to talk about the importance of understanding history as a means to anticipate the contemporary challenges and, of course, you know, frame a proper strategy for the future. So it's those ideas that I think really encapsulate those officers of that generation. Obviously, they were aware of the political scene, but they did not allow political elements get in the way of what they felt was their duty, if you understand what I mean. These people were of deep-seated, you know, principle. They understood what it was to be an American. They respected the Constitution. and the system that we created after the American Revolution. Dudley Knox, of course, later on writes a book called The Naval Genius of George Washington. You know, it's interesting. You know, these guys really felt proud to be American, and they were particularly proud to be naval officers.
Another thing that struck my mind when I was reading the book is one thing that I wish I had learned earlier on in my life than I did, but that's the critical nature of personal networks that you build up. On the Army side of the house, you know, a lot of times when people think of Patton and Eisenhower, they think of what they saw in the movies and how they interacted in World War II. But Patton and Eisenhower had known each other since 1918. They were in regular correspondence with each other. I believe some of their letters they exchanged were actually in French and German to test each other. But all those leaders at World War II, they just didn't meet each other shortly after 7 December. They had built relationships and networks in a day where things moved at the speed of a train. But they were able to do it, and that really made a difference during the war. And in a similar way, and you've mentioned some of the names, and almost bookends his career in many ways, but Knox had built a network of professional relationships that, as you've touched on briefly, really had an impact on our Navy as it grew from a second to a primary power, whether you're talking about Sims or also Ernest King. Touch on a bit on some of the tools that they use or some of the interesting interactions you found upon that professional network of acquaintances and friends that he had developed during that period.
Well, I think Ernest King is probably one of the more important associations that Knox had. Not just because King became, you know, the CNO and also the comminch, which, of course, you know, the merger of the two jobs made him probably the most powerful naval officer in American history. You know, those guys, their relationship goes all the way back to 1895, 96, when they were both at the Naval Academy together. Of course, King was junior to Knox. He's class of 01 and Knox is class of 1897. But they knew each other as far back as that. And of course, when you trace these guys' relationships, you can see the network that each of these guys is part of. It's almost a tribal type of thing. In my dissertation work, I focused on Ernest King, and of course Knox is one of King's closest associates, but also I would note that Knox and King were affiliated with Chester W. Nimitz as far back as 1906, 1907. And so it is my argument that if you're trying to understand the Second World War, right, you have to actually go back to the beginning of the lives of the people who actually commanded the forces of the Second World War. So, yeah, I'm arguing that in order to understand the events of the Second World War, you kind of have to start in that immediate post-Civil War reconstruction period in order to understand how these people were thinking and how they associated with one another. One other thing that I would want to point out for the listeners is I'm a true believer in what Knox says about navies, that their functions are multiple, and potentially navies are most important in peacetime because they are almost designed to avoid the war in the first place. It's not, you know, an end state that you're trying to achieve if you're trying to have a war. I mean, that's not something you should be looking to do. And it was people like Knox who truly believed that their job was actually to avoid the war in the first instance, and of course to win it when required. If an enemy is absolutely dead set on having a war with you, well, you need to win that war. And that's sort of the mentality that Knox had. And one thing I would point out, when you look at the careers of people like Knox, King, Nimitz, Halsey, all these guys. You know, you're looking at people who served in the Navy for over 50 years. And when you look at the amount of time that they actually spent in their careers fighting wars, it's only about 8 years. When you think about that, you think about a 50-year career, it's only about 8 years that they're actually fighting in actual wars, spending most of their time in their naval service in peacetime and training and educating themselves and reading history and understanding the profession that they're in. And I must say, I am not quite sure if our contemporary Navy is as sophisticated as it once was with people like Dudley Knox and Ernest King in the ranks. I mean, we can debate that one, but, you know.
Well, as I was reading a book, I was kind of amused because I kept thinking that somebody doing the Navy advertising had to be looking at Knox at some point, you know, a global force for good. to get to you, they have to come through us, you know, and the whole, all that advertising relates to protection of the sea lanes and all that stuff, which, you know, was right out, as far as I could tell, right out of what Knox was thinking. So I was kind of impressed with that. But I was also impressed by the fact that Knox made a big deal about initiative for junior officers, but giving them a doctrine level, or a level of doctrine from which they could refer to in their guidance. Could you kind of run through that a little bit?
Yeah. So his prize-winning essay from 1915 was, of course, he talks about doctrine. Today, when we talk about doctrine, we talk about it almost in terms of you must follow the rules and stay within the lines when you're in the coloring book, so to speak. But in Knox's assertion is that basically doctrine is nothing more than the starting point of creativity. I mean, you have to know the basic rules in order to be creative. So it's almost like he actually says that it's like reading a sheet of music. You know, that's the sort of guidelines to play the music, but, you know, to be really genius at music, you have to be able to adjust from that basis. So his assertions about doctrine is we should all understand the doctrine, but we shouldn't be enslaved by the doctrine at all. In fact, we should examine doctrine as being imperfect and constantly try and refine it and improve upon it. It's not the end-all and be-all. Doctrine is only, you know, the sort of basis of creativity. And that's really what Knox is trying to say. And I think that's why he won the prize in 1915. Of course, what's important about this also is he wrote that article when he was a student at the Naval War College with William S. Sims and Pete Ellis was in the same class. So it's a interesting class, the class of 1913, at the Naval War College. You got some really interesting characters, and they're all thinking along the same lines in terms of both the function of navies and also, of course, the idea that you need doctrine in order to adapt to challenges. You know, no enemy is the same twice. So each time you're facing a different enemy, you have to adapt to the enemy that you're facing, and also have a clear understanding of what it is you're trying to accomplish with regards to your adversary. And those are the basic principles of what Knox was trying to say about the role of doctrine in naval warfare.
Let's bring up that word you just mentioned a little bit ago, thinking, and also a previous answer you brought up, and it might be a little bit of a loaded term, but I think it's applicable to my question here, and that is the sophistication of thought, sophisticated thinkers and leaders. Now, Knox had a pretty firm idea of what he considered essential as an intellectual foundation for naval officer, naval thinkers, and what they should do. And we find ourselves today, and this has been true for a few decades, where we have a Navy that intentionally has a codified bias towards highly technical education for its junior officers, even ongoing through a career, to the detriment of the other half of the brain. If you could talk for a bit about what Knox thought was essential and what you might think of his thoughts would be about a rather extreme bias towards a technical education for an officer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in my introduction, I actually quoted Ernest King, who talked about the problem of the Naval Academy, where they would teach you in these very mathematical sort of engineering approaches, and it got to the point where midshipmen would stand at a, and I'm quoting King, midshipmen would stand at the chalkboard chewing chalk before they would turn around and admit that they don't know the answer. Later on, of course, Knox, King, and Pye, William Pye, were part of a sort of a ad hoc board, and they produced a report about the role of education in the future sort of strategy of the U.S. Navy. And one of the things that they point out is that the naval service is the most varied profession in the world, and it's absolutely crucial that you understand the engineering principles, but also you have to broaden your perspective and understand the role of culture, you know, the basic strategic works in the literature. You know, they were reading things by John Knox Lofton and Spencer Wilkinson long before anybody ever heard of those names in the U.S. Navy. And, of course, you know, I've probably mentioned names like Spencer Wilkinson and John Knox Lofton. Most of your naval officers today probably wouldn't have a clue what I'm talking about. And, of course, they also read Corbett after the First World War. And these ideas were all there in these books, you know, the fundamental ideas of Mahan, which basically Mahan is repackaging the ideas of Wilkinson and Lofton. And, of course, you know, we all remember Mahan. But Knox, King, and Pye recognized that not everybody was reading these works, and they put it to paper. And when they produced that Knox, King, Pye board report, they concluded that the highest-ranking admiral in the United States Navy was only educated to the lowest commission grade. And so they argued that you have to go back and give opportunities to naval officers to develop a more advanced understanding of the world, and that can only be accomplished through education. And they argued that you should send naval officers to the Naval War College almost as a finishing school twice in their career before they should become flag officers. And, of course, in the Navy today, sure, it's an honor to go to the Naval War College, but it's not necessarily a place where they send, you know, the up-and-coming in the United States Navy. And it should be exactly the opposite. You should be sending the best and the brightest to the Naval War College. And it's absolutely crucial to the profession that your admirals have the opportunity to educate themselves along the way of a long naval career. And in the case of Knox and King, as I said before, these are people who served nominally either in retired status or on active status in King's case for over 50 years. And so, you know, when they say things like, hey, you know, that's great. You got a great solution there to that, you know, navigation problem. But what is it that you're trying to accomplish? Where are we going with all this? What is the Navy, in broader terms, supposed to be doing? Is it just a military service? No, of course not. It's always operational, whether in peace or in war. And I must say, this is an opinion. It's not, you know, anything other than that. It's an opinion. But I must say that if I were channeling Knox right now, he would be rather upset, I think, because of the fact that we're putting sailors in blue camouflage uniforms these days. He'd say, what the heck is that? You know, are we sailors or are we something else? Is this a joint Navy or is it just, you know, are we off the tracks? You know, I mean, we don't look like sailors anymore. And I think Knox would be the first to tell you, that if anything, you should be proud of being a sailor first, and you should be extremely proud of being an American sailor in the United States Navy.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Because I got this notice saying I've been disconnected, so I always worry when I see things like that. As I was reading through this, the knowledge of history is a dangerous thing. And when they were talking about, well, unless you have some way to usefully apply it, but Knox is in there talking about micromanagement and how they used to write orders so that every detail of a proposed operation was laid out, I guess, down to the finite, the little tiny details, which, of course, I'm sitting there going, well, no plan long survives contact with reality. But I'm also thinking, he made a big emphasis on having the commanders in the field, the commander in the field. You didn't have to pay, you shouldn't have paid any attention. He didn't, apparently didn't think, to orders that came from somebody who wasn't there on scene. And I was looking just read a book on Grant and Shiloh and Halleck giving these orders from afar that, caused, was in many ways responsible for the disaster of the first day of Shiloh. And I was thinking that, was the thinking that he had on that, not only based on Napoleonic things, but on things that he had learned as a result of the American Civil War and other debacles in history.
Well, of course, Knox is related to a number of Army people. He's also the brother-in-law of Douglas MacArthur. So when you look at his personal experience, the influences upon his thinking, he is aware of Army culture. He, grew up as the son of an Army general, and he corresponded throughout his life with Douglas MacArthur. So he understands the Army point of view, but what's really great about Knox is he also, developed a unique understanding of sea power that I think perhaps was even more advanced than that of Alfred Thayer Mahan. He was one of these guys who understood the broader global perspective. And I think it was Naval Genius of George Washington where he wrote that all naval officers understand that naval operations are primarily focused upon creating an effect ashore. So, to respond to your sort of question, I think, the idea that you have naval officers who have this deeper understanding that the Navy is different than the Army, but they understand the Army point of view at the same time. I think that's truly the mark of a true professional. And I would also hasten to say that Knox truly also understood the role of diplomacy and the influence of politics. He served in retirement status as the director of Naval Archives and Library, Naval Records and Library, under, four different presidents. So he understood the Washington battlefield as much as he understood the battlefields of the world. So he is truly an interesting character. That's what I would really emphasize to any reader is that this is a personality who is worthy of study and reflection. I think there's a lot to learn from him.
Yeah, I just realized that we could probably do an hour on each chapter of the book because I can't seem to get out of the intro. But I thought it was also interesting about his background, and I wonder if you have some insight for us on how it influenced his thoughts and his priorities. But for a man whose juicy foundation years of a young naval officer were defined by the Great White Fleet and the World War I Castles of Steel, et cetera, and so forth, he had a predilection not for the great capital fleet, the big bold-faced item Navy, but from what was described as the working class Navy. Talk for a little bit about some of his career choices and how that influenced not just his thoughts, but also how it helped him influence the thinking of other leaders.
Yeah, so Knox would be very proud to tell you that his first command was a tugboat in Cuban waters, right? As a past midshipman, he had command. And I think that's something that we're missing in today's Navy. When you get out of the Naval Academy, you don't have command until you make it to the rank of, you know, lieutenant commander, commander. So when the CNO is worried about, you know, problems of leadership, I would tell him two things. One, get him out of these stupid digital camouflage uniforms, and two, put your ensigns in command of something. Give them a canoe, you know, give them the opportunity to lead at the earliest point in their careers. And I think that's exactly what Knox would tell you to do, because he was very proud of his first command, which was really nothing more than a tugboat. But the other thing that I would say in response to your question is he was the sort of advisor to people like Ernest King. And, of course, when both of them served in the destroyer flotilla with Captain Sims, who became Admiral Sims later on, in the Narragansett Bay, they were in the destroyers, and they were the first really to experiment with wireless communications in 1915, developing tactics to use wireless that could be applied to larger type warships. They were developing procedures by breaking all the rules. They didn't mind bumping into the pier with their ships, you know. They didn't mind if they scraped the hull a little bit. They worked hard, and they partied hard, too. That's for darn sure. I've read a lot about Ernest King's ability to have a good time. And, you know, I live in Rhode Island, of course, and I go to work every day at the Naval War College, and I'm reminded of these guys every day that I go to work. So it's a tremendous privilege for me to be here. But that's, you know, a culture of service that I think is lacking in the contemporary Navy. I don't know. I'm sure there's other people who would disagree with me, but these guys did not mind going out and getting the job done and training very, very hard, but also recognizing that nothing is static. Things are always changing, and they understood that they had to adapt to change. When they ended up going to World War One, of course, Knox and King are lieutenant commanders at the beginning of the First World War. By the end of the war, they're both captains. And Knox recognized he had a physical ailment, which sort of influenced his decisions, but he went on the retired list in 1921 because he recognized that there was nowhere for him to go with all these other senior-ranking guys dominating the flag ranks. And he actually advised King, because King was 2 years junior to Knox, and said, hey, you know, Ernest, you know, you need to think about doing something with your career that is you know, outside the regular line of battleships. And, of course, you see Knox going to the Navy Records and Library in retired status. So, and I'll explain that in a minute. And he continues to serve at the Navy Department in the Records and Library. When King decided to go out of the battleship line, and, of course, King was a battleship sailor all the way up to 1920, and King went into submarines. And, of course, when he was in submarines, he, you know, met all these submariners, Thomas Hart, Savvy Cook, Charles Savvy Cook, and, of course, Francis Lowe in the 1920s. And, of course, all these guys during the Second World War are working very closely with Ernest King when he's in charge of U.S. naval strategy on the global scale. All these connections date back to the, you know, First World War era. And I must say, in the Navy today, you choose your rate and you choose your fate. So, you know, if you're a surface warfare officer, if you want to be an admiral someday, you got to stay in the surface warfare officer track. And if you don't follow the right sort of career wickets, and if you don't check the right blocks and work with the right people and always say yes when the right answer might be no, well, you're not going to be an admiral. Back in those days, these guys said, you know, I'm not going to stay in the battleship line. I'm going to go to submarines, or heck, I'll go ahead and volunteer to be an aviator. And then I can always go back to the regular line. I mean, once you know how to drive a ship, you can drive any ship. And that's the attitude that Ernest King and Dudley Knox had. They looked at the Navy as an adventure. And also, it was more than just a profession. I think these guys sort of approached the Navy in the same way that, you know, when priests become ordained in their religion or whatever, they sort of went into it with that attitude, that they were the high priests of their particular faith, which happened to be the Navy.
Yeah, I want to get away from the grand strategy side of things. One of the chapters you included, yeah, one of the essays you included, was his Elements of Leadership, mm-hmm, which I don't know why that's still not required reading for every junior officer in the fleet, because he lays it out really well. How much was he influenced in some of his thinking by the scientific management theories that were floating around about the time he was doing some of this leadership work and talking about how things ought to be for structure of the Navy?
Well, I think he understood the scientific approach. I mean, he's a Naval Academy graduate. He did quite well in math. But I think Knox was one of the rare personalities who understood that, you know, people are not scientific in their approaches to the world. People are people. And so I really think Knox was, deep down inside, I think he was a true humanist who understood that human beings are not, you know, necessarily predictable. And so if you're looking at war as a human dynamic, you can now understand that your adversary is subject to all the flaws that all of us are subject to, and they can be defeated if you understand your enemy well enough. And I think when Knox looks at leadership within the ranks, he's saying, look, we're all people. We're all subject to our own sort of flaws and you know, bad assumptions and all that. But, you know, if we work together and we're open and honest with each other from the top down to the lowest ranking sailor, and we work as a team, we can achieve great things together. And everybody has a function, you know, the rank system is what it is, but Knox would have been the first. In fact, he wrote that in the Elements of Leadership. He would have been the first to say, I want to know exactly what's going on with every one of my sailors, because I care about my sailors, and it's part of my job as the commander to take care of my people, so that when the time comes and I have to order that sailor potentially to do something that might result in you know, my sailor being killed, I want to understand what my sailors are capable of doing. And he took a lot of time getting to understand his people. And he wrote about that in the Elements of Leadership. And I think that's something that it's an art. It's not a science. And Knox, I think, is truly an artist in this respect.
I think he also, I like how you put it as an artist, because he has definitely an artist's passion about the topics that he cares about. And one of the things that was near and dear to my heart when I read the book is, and I found quite reassuring, I think some people might find it frustrating, but there are some topics that are evergreen. They're as true in 2016 as they are in 1926. And I think it's reassuring and good in the fact that it should tell those that are engaged in the conversation that others have been there before for similar reasons, but human nature being what it is, the important things need to be continually fought for and reinforced. And towards the last third of the book, there's an article from 1926 written by Knox, Our Vanishing History and Traditions. And one of the quotes that got me is over on 104. He said, a little long quote here, quote, however diligent the Navy Department may be in bringing together and archiving such records as are now in the custody of the branches of the naval establishment and of other governmental departments, it can never adequately safeguard our early history and traditions without interest and aid of officers and the relatives of former officers, unquote. And I think that plays into his idea that it has to be engaged, that it has to be part of a culture, that it has to be part of a passion. And what were his concerns and his priorities when it came to the importance to the now of history and traditions for what went before?
Yeah, so when he wrote that article, of course, he's working in Navy records and library, and he became deeply frustrated by the fact that he was coming across documents that were in terrible state of repair. I mean, in other words, Revolutionary War documents that were just sitting there to be taken or lost or destroyed, and professional naval officers basically not worrying about it and not taking much time to preserve the rich history of their own service. And Knox, being who he was, I think recognized that the foundation of the service was its own history. And the fact that nobody was doing anything at the time to not only preserve the history, but even more importantly, to understand what can be, you know, drawn from that history for application in the contemporary context. Knox wrote that article basically to scold his fellow naval officers to stop looking to the future all the time and worrying about the immediate moment, and take a minute and think about what your profession is all about. And it's a long profession. It's not just an American profession. It's the naval profession. And, you know, this is something that you have earned the right to be part of, and we have to spend some time to make sure that it's here when future generations follow in your wake in the naval service. So history is absolutely critical to Knox's point of view, which is very contemporary and strategic in focus. But he looks to the past as the basis for solving the problems of the present and creating strategies for the future. And that's what that article is all about. And I think it's a brilliant article, and that's why I picked it out.
At one point when I was reading the book, I had all these thoughts about, you know, somewhere in the one of the articles he's talking about how the Navy doesn't train its junior officers for command. In other words, I mean, you've already discussed that. We should have more Lieutenant JG commands, and kind of like the Coast Guard, I guess, and then go up. But in the middle of that, he was talking about how we had never really fought against a vastly superior foe. And then right at that moment, I thought Taffy 3. And I was wondering, as you know, looking, trying to put yourself in his shoes, and you look back at the Battle of Samar and what were there, 5 tin cans or 6 tin cans against, you know, battleships and cruisers? What would, and Knox was alive at this time, did he ever say write anything about Taffy 3? Because that seemed to me to be one of those really historical things that we should keep in our minds today. And I can't imagine he wasn't impressed by that at the time.
He was deeply impressed, and yes, he did write about it. He worked with Commodore Bates, who was up here at the Naval War College. They did the battle studies. So during the Second World War, Knox was involved with compiling battle reports with intelligence, and then they would produce these histories of battles that had taken place, you know, a couple months before, and they would actually come up with conclusions and recommendations. So if you face a situation like Taffy 3, these are some of the things that you might think about doing. So, yeah, he did write about it, and it was a classified history, and it was part of the Battle Studies Group material. What's interesting about that, of course, is that during the First World War, Dudley Knox was a plank owner of the OPNAV staff. He helped create the OPNAV staff, Operations Navy staff, and worked in the Office of Naval Intelligence, and he created a branch called the Historical Section of the Office of Naval Intelligence. And that's exactly what they did, is that they would take first-hand reports, intelligence, and they compile it together, and they would do that first draft of history as far back as the First World War. And, of course, you carry that through to the Second World War. That's exactly what Knox is doing once again in the rank of captain. He was made a commodore at the end of the war, Second World War. And what they were doing is they were actually doing the first-level history by taking original source documents, interviewing the participants, you know, capturing the message traffic, and then producing recommendations based upon events that had just transpired. That is something we don't really do anymore in the same way to the level of, you know, detail that they did it. And I think there's something to be learned from that. I would also hasten to say that some of the people who worked for Knox during the Second World War included Robert Greenhall Albion, who was a very accomplished historian, but also Michener and Phil Lundeberg and others who served on the Navy Department Historical Section during the war. And then, again, they were attached to the Office of Naval Intelligence. So, you know, this is actual sort of operational analysis that was being done by Knox during both world wars, and it's something that isn't really done in the same way today. I would argue that it might be a mission that the Naval History and Heritage Command could potentially pick up at some point in the future. It would be a good thing to do for our Navy, because we're not really doing it in the same way that they did it during the world wars with Dudley Knox at the helm.
You know, to our great shame, but that's just my personal opinion. I wanted to back up a little bit here, and because you talked briefly about what he did during the Second World War, but what's also interesting, and you have a real nice bit from 1937 on naval power as a preserver of neutrality and peace, is mm-hmm. he was an influencer upon FDR and a lot of the intellectual work about the Navy and its roles and its missions during the 1930s. Touch a little bit on how he got in the circle of Roosevelt and some of the influence he had in that thinking in the build-up to the war.
Well, of course, they met for the first time during the First World War when Franklin Roosevelt was Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And then in 1932, Roosevelt actually called him up to meet with him at Campobello, and also at Hyde Park on a number of occasions, just to talk about history, just, you know, to shoot the wind and drink martinis and smoke cigars and that kind of thing, just talking about naval history. And they became very, very close friends. And as a result of that friendship, Franklin Delano Roosevelt came to rely on the advice of Dudley Knox. And that's really a connection that I think is really important for people to think about when they think about Roosevelt's naval strategy before the Second World War. His neutrality strategy was, you know, I mean, Knox was one of the people who's the architect of the neutrality policies that Roosevelt basically framed before the Second World War. And one thing I would really stress, in that period between 1936 and 1941, the last thing on planet Earth that Franklin Delano Roosevelt wanted to do was to get involved in the Second World War. He did not want to be involved in that war at all. He did want the Japanese to stop doing what they were doing in China, and he certainly didn't want Hitler to take Britain. That's why we supported Britain so strongly after 1939. But the last thing on planet Earth that Franklin Delano Roosevelt wanted to do was to get directly involved in the Second World War. And one of the people behind the scenes who was influencing Roosevelt's thinking was Dudley Knox. And Knox, in retired status, was advising both Roosevelt and his friend Harold Rainsford Stark, the chief of naval operations. And when they were meeting with the British in 1940-41, it's Knox who's actually helping to frame American strategy, which was designed primarily to limit the prospect of direct American involvement in what became known as the Second World War. So it's an interesting sort of contrast to the popular understanding that Roosevelt really wants to get deeply involved in World War II. That's exactly not what he wanted to do. His strategy was designed primarily to limit the prospect of American involvement in the Second World War. Nobody wanted to repeat what had transpired in the First World War, and we certainly didn't want to get entangled in another foreign war. I would say that Dudley Knox and Ernest King and Chester Nimitz were deeply chagrined at the fact that they decided to maintain the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They were deeply chagrined at Winston Churchill's speech on in March of 1946, in which he said special relationship and Iron Curtain. And they were deeply chagrined that the whole objective of the United States in the Second World War was basically hijacked after the Second World War, and we were sort of dragged into a new role as the sort of inheritor of the British Empire. And it's people like Knox and King and Nimitz who are a little bit worried about what this new brave world was in the post-Second World War period. And that's why I included that essay at the end of the book that Knox wrote called The Problem of Unification. And, you know, Knox is basically articulating some of the problems of this new role that the United States had. And he's saying, look, we're not really configured as a democracy to perform the functions of an empire, and yet here we are.
I was going to ask you about that particular essay because he took a pretty strong stand about the separation of the Air Force from the Army and why it's important that the Navy and Marine Corps have their own air wings and why the Army was making a fantastic mistake by just letting the Air Force drift off to take up this magic of strategic bombing stuff. What kind of feedback did he catch for that, if any, from those positions?
So there is an essay that he quoted, Charles Savvy Cook, who is one of the lead planners during World War II, very close to Ernest King and, of course, a good friend of Dudley Knox. And the article that Knox quoted in that essay was called Soldiers Need Wings. And if you go and read that article by Savvy Cook, he talks about why soldiers need wings. He talks about during World War II, the infantry always required that close air support from, you know, the Army Air Forces or in the Pacific, of course, the Navy and Marine Corps were providing close air support to their troops as they maneuvered on the ground. And if you read that article, Savvy Cook ends it by saying, if soldiers don't have wings, they will earn them in a future battle. And he leaves it at that. And basically, he leaves it with, they will earn them in a future battle. And the implication, of course, is he means that they will become angels if they don't have wings. So it's an interesting article because Savvy Cook is basically saying that the way that they won World War II was by close air support to the maneuver forces on the ground, not through strategic air power. And then, of course, Knox is using that same theme to say, look, okay, we can do strategic air power, but we cannot lose sight of the fact that you have to provide air support to both troops on the ground and the ships at sea. And as a result, he's basically arguing that the Army should maintain an Air Force and the Navy should maintain an Air Force, and that there was really no need for a separate Air Force at all. And that's basically the gist of that article. And I think, you know, it's something to think about when we're paying for this, what is it, the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter? How much is that one costing us? And it can't even land on an aircraft carrier.
Oh, don't even get me started on that. and he was very prescient about that. And when I was thinking, as I want to do, about historical characters, I try to bring them, if you could reanimate them for 24 hours and sit around and talk. I was like, what nowadays I think would be worthy of an interesting conversation with good Commodore Knox. He wasn't a big fan of buzzword bingo, I think is a fair phrase to say, and I don't think he'd be too kind with the hip topic of the fiscal quarter that everybody wants to make sure to include the one or two words in their title or subtitle. And it has
like
some
cyber
legs. I think it's an ongoing topic. The last few years, and a couple of good friends to the show have been kind of two hell fellow, well-met, happy warriors of two sides of an argument or discussion. You have the big ship, capital ship, carrier crowd with Brian McGrath. Of course, I'm talking about the great carrier debate and the ongoing echoes we've had from it. And, of course, the smaller, more flexible Navy model that may be a bit more affordable, at least a per-unit basis, with Jerry Henricks, I think is a fascinating article that definitely is forward-looking, but it has a lot of references to the past. Having studied Knox arguably probably more than anybody else has in the last few years, where do you think, if not where he would stand, or what part of this discussion do you think that Knox would find the most interesting, given the position of the U.S. in 2016?
I think Dudley Knox would come right down the middle of McGrath and Henricks. Personally, I'm closer to Henricks than I would be to McGrath's point of view. But I think, you know, if I were channeling Knox, he would say you need that sort of balance between the two, the smaller ships, the nimble ships, you know, commanded by junior officers. You need to have that. You have to have the sort of PC fleet, the PT boats. You got to have those things. Submarines should be commanded by, you know, lieutenant commanders. And those lieutenant commanders, once they finish their tour on a submarine, they should be well fit and qualified to command a battleship. And if they have wings, if they know how to fly an airplane, well, you know, go ahead and put them on an aircraft carrier command. But we're all line officers. There's no separation. We're all sailors. And I think Knox would say you need a balance. You need those big capital ships, but he would be very wary of the industrial sort of influences, trying to spend your money for you, selling you ships that you don't need. He would warn you against that. He'd say, look, you don't need a ship that is state-of-the-art. You just need a ship that floats and that can survive a battle. And then he would also probably tell you that if you're worried about leadership, if that's a problem in the Navy, well, give people the opportunity to command as soon as you can, as soon as they're out of the Naval Academy, and put them in command of a PT boat or a PC as soon as they're graduated from the Naval Academy, and make sure that, you know, they have the training that they need to succeed, but give them the earliest opportunity to lead. And I think that's what Knox would say to you. As an aside, I remember McGrath was the skipper of the Bulkley when I was the N2 of Deseron 2-8 a few years ago, and he was a great skipper. And I must say, he's a tremendous thinker, and I have a lot of respect for him. But I must say also that I fall a little bit closer, I think, personally, to Jerry Hendrix's point of view on what the Navy should look like.
And on that, Dave, boy, what a quick and thoroughly enjoyable hour. I highly recommend to the listeners, please go check out the work that Dave has edited, 21st Century Knox. As I mentioned earlier on in the show, we could easily do a show on each chapter of the book. I think there's a lot that Commodore Knox can definitely inform us with in 2016 and forward. And just for the listeners, Dave, we mentioned in the intro and over in the show page, we have links to other works that you've done. What are you working on right now? And if people wanted to keep an ear out for what Dave might be pushing out here through the rest of the year and through 2017, where could they go?
So I'm working on – so you know how this goes. You start on a subject, and it's the never-ending book. So my dissertation was about Ernest J. King and his headquarters of the Second World War. And I'm now building off of that dissertation. It's a 10-chapter study of Ernest King through both world wars, and it culminates at the end of the Second World War. And the working, I'm right now in chapter 8 out of 10. So in a couple months, I'll be finished with the whole manuscript, and I'll be submitting it for publication. And the working title of the book will be Two Kings and a Navy. And I'm looking at Anglo-American collaboration and the role of Ernest J. King in bringing together the two maritime nations, Britain and the United States. And, of course, you know, they also worked with this thing called the Soviet Union during the Second World War. And I'm looking at how he helped develop that special relationship and how he was tremendously important to building the Navy that we have today. And, of course, one of his closest advisors was Dudley Wright Knox. And just to close out, I would like to read a quote very quickly that Knox gives to us, and I'd like to leave it with that because I think it's an important quote. And Knox basically says that navies provided the unique means, quote, not to make war, but to preserve peace, not to be predatory, but to shield the free development of commerce, not to unsettle the world, but to stabilize it through the promotion of law and order, unquote. I think that's essentially Knox right there.
In a nutshell, and again, thank you very much, Dave, for coming on. It's been a great hour, and we wish you well for the rest of the year.
Thank you
so much.
Thanks
a lot. Thanks a lot, Dave. And when you get your King book done, let us know so we can maybe have you back and discuss at least one chapter out of that book.
Perfect.
Amen.
Go Navy.
And there we go. And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrats. We will have a best of next weekend for Father's Day, but please join us again live on the 26th, where our guest will be Bill Roggio of the Long War Journal. And until then, hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
It's a long way to Tipperary.